Hello, I'm Danny Aiken, president of Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. We want to thank you for listening to this chapel message. Our mission at Southeastern is to seek to glorify the Lord Jesus Christ by equipping students to serve the church and fulfill the Great Commission. We hope that you enjoy this chapel message and that you will visit our website. It's www.sebts.edu. There you can learn more about our school and what the Lord is doing here. We hope you enjoy the message. Thank you for being a part of what we're doing here.
Well, good morning, and thank you to those of you who've decided to come back. What I want us to do is look at the subject of slavery, and I want to begin with a quotation from a well-known atheist writer in the U.S., atheist Sam Harris, who wrote the book Letter to a Christian Nation. So that's letter to you guys, I suppose. And this is what he says. In assessing the moral wisdom of the Bible, it's useful to consider moral questions that have been solved to everyone's satisfaction. Consider the question of slavery. The entire civilized world now agrees that slavery is an abomination. What moral instruction do we get from the God of Abraham on this subject? Consult the Bible and you'll discover that the creator of the universe clearly expects us to keep slaves. Now you can see the slightly weaseling verb expects there in the last line, and you can say, well, there we have the way he's trying to move us from perhaps allowing something to expecting and so on. But that would be unfair to deal with Sam Harris like that, because he goes on then to quote the Bible. The very next thing he quotes from the Revised Standard Version is this passage. As for your male and female slaves whom you may have, you may buy male and female slaves from among the nations that are round about you. You may also buy from among the strangers who sojourn with you and their families that are with you, who have been born in your land, and they may be your property. You may bequeath them to your sons after you to inherit as a possession forever. You may make slaves of them, but over your brethren, the people of Israel, you shall not rule one over another with harshness. So you can see that text, and it's a very important text, I would say, of all of the texts in the whole Bible. If you want to find the text that's going to be most seemingly pro-slavery, this would be the text to go to. And so here Sam Harris is quoting the Bible, and that makes it more awkward. We can disagree with Sam Harris, but, you know, this is the Bible, so we can't disagree with that, can we? Now, what we need to see is that there are a number of words here that make us feel uncomfortable. The word slaves, these arrows aren't going to align because it's been made 16:9, so I'm going to just have to show you where they're going to have to go. Slaves by property and possession. Oh no, this is no, not good. Let's move on. Okay, there is a problem. What's the problem? The problem is this, that Bible translations talk about slaves. In the Old Testament, no objection is made to having slaves. In the New Testament, Christians are not commanded to free their slaves. In fact, slaves are told to submit. Therefore, biblical texts approve of slavery. We know that slavery is wrong. Therefore, biblical texts approve of something that is wrong. So you see the argument. Now, does anyone feel the force of that? Anyone at all out there feel the force of this? I know it's morning. Does anyone out there feel the force of the argument? No one out there. One or two nods. Okay. So hopefully, since you're in a college which espouses biblical truth, you're feeling uncomfortable at this stage, because here we have a problem and you're hoping desperately there's going to be some deliverance from the problem. Well, let's look at the subject of translation to begin with. Just look at the terms that are being used. One of the striking things about the use of the word slave is there's been an immense rise in the occurrence of the word slave in English translations. Go back to the old King Jim translation of 1611, and you find that they only had one occurrence of this word in the Old Testament, one in the New Testament, and five in the apocryphal books. The one in the New Testament is translating the word soma in the book of Revelation, where it's clearly trading in bodies is disapproved of. And then we have an occurrence in Jeremiah 2. When we have the New King James translation in revises that, we see it has more occurrences, the New International, New Revised Standard Version, yet more. Jewish Publication Society back in 1917 has just three occurrences of this word when it comes to be revised. In 1985, it has 135. Of course, that's just with the Old Testament. go across to German translations, and we find a similar pattern. The German equivalent word, the cognate word, in its masculine and feminine forms, did not occur in the original Luther Bible, nor in subsequent revisions up until 1912. Still no occurrences. But when that was revised in 1984, there are 70 occurrences. The Elberfelder even has 161, and four of the words slavery. We go to Spanish translations, and we find a similar pattern. The Reina Valera translation in 1909 has just four occurrences of the masculine and feminine equivalents of this term, and by 1960 and 1995, considerably more, 25 and 65 occurrences, respectively. This is generally happening in the Germanic and Romance languages, although the North Germanic, the Scandinavian languages, do something somewhat differently. We could go across to our Italian translations. The Diodati translation, the old one, has virtually no occurrences. The NDodati, which is the new Diodati in the middle, standard Protestant translation, has about 100. The Jerusalem translation, the Catholic translation in Italian, actually, I think, scores almost a European record in having close to 300 occurrences of this word, generally rendering the Hebrew word eved, and so on. But I'm giving you occurrences, in this case, across the Old and New Testaments. Go to Afrikaans, which is a comparatively new language, but of course one where oppression is a very interesting narrative. And in the six left-hand columns, we have the Old Afrikaans translation for its Old Testament and its New Testament and the masculine, feminine, and plural forms. In the six right-hand columns, we have the newer translations, and you can see a significant rise in the number of occurrences of these words. Now, that's all very interesting, at least to me, maybe not to you, but what we can do is we can look at a text like Jeremiah 2:14, which is the one occurrence we have of this word slave in the Old Testament. And it goes like this: is Israel a servant, using the Hebrew word eved? Is he a homeborn slave? And the Hebrew we have there is yelid bayit, born in a home, which really is the equivalent of homeborn. And the King James has in italics the word slave because there's no Hebrew original. The earliest versions of the King James actually use small print for the same thing. So the point is, the only time that you have the word slave in the King James Old Testament is when you need a B parallel form to be parallel to an A phrase. So in other words, when you've sort of run out of words and you need another one, you search around and find the word slave. Of course, the King James Version is just slightly before what seems to be North American slavery beginning, which might be put somewhere around 1619. So that has to be factored in. But Shakespeare uses the word slave a reasonable number of times. It was a word that could have been used, and it's a word that's pretty absent there. Contrast that translation with the New Revised Standard Version. The New Revised Standard Version is actually identical for this verse, but with one little difference, namely that the words slave and servant have been switched around. Now the word slave is the natural equivalent in people's minds of the word eved, and the word servant is the B word when you need to find an extra term. This can lead to some interesting inconsistencies. Take the logic of the RSV in Leviticus 25:42. Talks about Israel as my servants, avadai, plural of eved, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold as slaves. Now, why switch between two terms? Well, what's happened is people have liked to have this idea that eved, which occurs 800 times in the Old Testament, basically has good occurrences and bad occurrences. So when we have Moses being the eved Adonai, we like to say he's the servant of the Lord. On the other hand, when we have other occurrences, we tend to think of them as slaves. And when we have an occurrence where someone is talking to a superior, they might well say, what does my Lord say to his eved? And in that case, we just think it's servant and it's just politeness. Now, I want to say that I don't think there is actually that differentiation between good and bad eved in the Old Testament. When we come to the rendering of these terms in the Pentateuch, in the Greek Pentateuch, the work of the 70 translators, we find that generally the word doulos does not occur. It occurs thrice in the Pentateuch, that's all. The words paisterapon and oiketes are more generally used. When we come to later portions of Greek translations of the Old Testament, and therefore we look at the so-called Septuagint as a whole, by the way, I think Septuagint is a very modern construct, really a 17th century idea, but we can come on to that if we like. If you want to discuss that afterwards, I'm very anti the idea that there is a Septuagint. But anyway, we'll use it for today. When we look at this so-called thing, we find that there's far more occurrences of doulos as a whole. But in the early, the first Greek books to be translated, namely the Pentateuch, it really wasn't occurring very much. And I think that's significant because there's a rise in the understanding of Eved in a more negative way as we get closer to the Roman Empire. Now, this word Eved is not, I believe, a negative term. Take the fact that Shema, who is the Eved of Jeroboam, is rather proud to be so. He he's got his seal impression that you can see here, and I'm sure you can all read Paleo Hebrew, so that's no problem. There we have it on the second line, where he's the Eved. It's the three letters on the right on the second line, which gives you the Ayin Beit dialect. So what we can say is this is something that's very positive. For Moses, the only time he gets called the Eved of God is once he's dead. It's something that's honorific. He gets it once, you know, Moses, my servant, has died, and that's when he gets it. When does Joshua get called that? Once he's dead. It's something that's very striking and very rare to be allowed to be the Eved of God. It's a privileged position. So it's rather different from the word slave. One scholar who looked at the root Ayin Beit dialect in the Old Testament said it's a dynamic relational term. The one who is signified thereby is signified as dependent from the relation partner. That's really how we should say Eved always works. So it's not a term about oppression, nor is it a term about ownership, which is usually what our modern word slave is about. It's really a term of, it's a relational term. You have to be an Eved of someone. It implies that relation. It implies dependence. It implies subordination. And really, it's related more to our VAD, the idea of working. So when we look at this term, although nowadays it gets translated both servant and slave, all English translations still render the majority of occurrences of this term as servant, and yet in certain cases they're using the word slave. I don't think it's inherently negative. You might want to say, well, isn't Eved Avadim, servant of servants, slave of slaves, which is said of what Canaan will be in Genesis 9:25. Isn't that negative? Well, I think obviously it is, cursed be Canaan, but it's not that the term itself is inherently negative so much as when you're a subordinate of a subordinate, that becomes a pretty negative thing as a whole, but it's not that the term is just doing that negative work on its own. So it really relates to work and being subservient. And of course, everyone, including everyone in the whole society, is a servant of the king. Those who are under Saul are his servants. So we don't have yet the idea growing up of free people independent of authority. That language of free person really begins probably with 5th century BC Athens. It would be a great PhD topic for someone to study, just the history of the notion of freedom, particularly how that develops in its early stages, because I think that's not really been considered very carefully. And of course, we have a very strong narrative of ourselves now being free, although of course when we're children we're not free to run out in the road, we hope our parents will stop us, and also as adults we tend to be not free to avoid taxes. So there we are. Let's look at the Old Testament institution then. When we look at the patriarchal system, the work that these people are doing is not working in cotton plantations in chains, but rather working as herdsmen, domestic servants. We find that Eliezer of Damascus, if Abraham doesn't manage to produce offspring, is going to be inheriting, as will the children of Bilhah and Zilpah, Jacob's second-tier wives. Of course, having second-tier wives is always a bad idea and always leads to domestic disputes, but that's another story. what we find is that the children of Hagar, Bilhah, and Zilpah are free. Now, that would be rather different from in what the standard slave societies that you would consider. We have also to remember that when we're dealing with this stage in the Old Testament, that New World slavery hasn't happened. Greco-Roman slavery hasn't happened. So we need to make sure that we do factor out all of those sorts of things when we're considering the Old Testament. These people, in Abraham's case, are trusted to travel with valuables, hundreds of miles, 10 camels with valuables off to find a wife for Isaac, or they're given weapons in order to go and rescue Lot. One of the things slave societies don't generally do is arm the slaves. And it seems that there isn't really an approved selling of people. You might say that the phrase miknath kesef, that means acquired by silver in Genesis 17:12, which it refers to those that Abraham should circumcise in his household, implies that he actually paid silver in order to acquire people, and I think that's a valid point. But I think what we don't see here is the idea of tradesmen going around selling people. So when we compare what's going on in the Old Testament with what might be going on in the Roman world or in the New World, slavery, we find a difference. In the Old Testament, of course, there is Sabbath for everyone, one day in seven. There's holiday. You have to look after people. You have to give them enough food. Legal redress, I think we can make a case that everyone had equal access to the city gate and to legal redress, which, of course, when you're being kidnapped from West Africa, you do not get. Sexual protection, yes, there are very strong laws about that sort of thing. Sex can only be within marriage, and, of course, when someone's married, that confers privileges. In the case of kidnapping is a capital offence. Chains, there are no mentions of chains in relation to servants or slaves in the Old Testament, but there is in the book of Ecclesiasticus. So we find that there's a striking difference there. With torture or physical abuse, again, that's absent, and if you so much as knock the tooth out of a servant or slave, you have to let them go free. Now, we can also look at runaway legislation in the Old Testament. This is what Deuteronomy says. You shall not give up to his master a slave who has escaped from his master to you. He shall dwell with you in your midst in the place that he shall choose within one of your towns, wherever it suits him. Now, I should say here, I'm quoting from the English Standard Version, and I am on the committee of the English Standard Version, and I did make an attempt to make sure all occurrences of Eved were rendered consistently as servant. I don't mind if they're all rendered slave. I would just like them to be consistent. So if we have them slave, it would be, what does my lord say to his slave? Which isn't, which is quite strong language, I suppose. I think servant's probably a far easier word for us to understand. In the case of the antebellum South, we can also say that there were some pretty harsh penalties. Here's one I found, that failure to hand over an escaped slave would mean 6 months imprisonment and, what was harder still, an $1,000 fine when the dollar was really worth rather a lot. Now, when we think of selling and buying, which is language which is used in Leviticus 25, we do need to recognize that there is selling and buying of people's labor. But what is going on? I think one of the most common things that we have going on is actually debt slavery or servitude. Think of this. You're in a society, a subsistence society, where there is no social welfare. You become poor for whatever reason. Maybe your ox dies. You basically have no collateral. And you need food. Well, in that context, the Old Testament commands people to supply you with food. But maybe that charity runs out. Maybe they're pretty short of any spare food. And so what you can do, the only thing you can do, is you can pledge your future work. That's all you can do. And that is, of course, what I think is often going on in the Old Testament. People are pledging future work. And that would explain, of course, why corporal punishment of these people is allowed. You might say, well, using corporal punishment on an adult human doesn't seem like a very nice thing. But the point is this. If you say, well, give me food today and I'll work for you tomorrow, and then tomorrow you say, well, I'm not going to work, what else is there? So I'm not saying that this is a wonderful system. I'm simply saying that there is some logic to it. And what goes on in the Old Testament is essentially people sell themselves or they sell their daughters. Now, when they sell their daughters, they're not trying to cash in on their daughters and see how many camels they can get for this beautiful young maid. Rather, what's going on is you've got to remember that with marriages in those days, they used to have financial transactions so that the groom would pay bride price to the bride's father, and the bride's father would pay the dowry to the wife. And of course, if the man cheats on the woman, he's going to lose access to that, and so on. So there was a new financial settlement in order to look after that new household. I do actually think that incorporating heavy financial penalties into marriages, and so, you know, if someone cheats on someone else, the person cheated on gets to keep the castle or whatever. I think those are generally good things, and it, you know, the lack of those in modern societies has not been positive. But what's really going on, I believe, is temporary leasing of people's work. There aren't salesmen and intermediaries talked about in the Bible. The one time, of course, when people do sell people is Joseph's brother selling him, and that was bad. And bodies retain rights, of course, and there's a theology of God owning everything. Now, I need to go into a digression here about how people misread Exodus, because people typically see the book of Exodus as the liberation of Israel from slavery. Nothing could be further from the truth. You see, what the book of Exodus says is, well, I've got a typo there, but there we are. Exodus 13:3, we have Moses said to the people, "Remember this day in which you came out from Egypt, out of the house of slavery." That's the way it's typically rendered. But what it actually is Beit Avadim, the house of servants or slaves. But who are these servants or slaves? Well, Deuteronomy will talk about we were Eved of Pharaoh. But if we look just at the way the book of Exodus expresses it, it will express it rather differently. The way the book of Exodus portrays the oppression of the Israelites, it will talk not about them being slaves, but about how they were oppressed with heavy burdens ruthlessly, and it will occasionally, in some renderings, use the word slaves. But obviously, in earlier renderings, such as the King James, this didn't happen. The main ways it expresses how bad this is by talking about bitter, hard service, including the word avodah, from Ayin Beit Dalet as a root. But what we see is rather a consistent avoidance of actually using the word Eved of the Israelites in Egypt. There isn't a slave-free contrast, that is, there's no language of liberation, there's language of bringing out of the Israelites from the land of Egypt. In fact, the people who are the Avadim in the book of Exodus are not the Israelites, but the Egyptians. You see all of these occurrences on the text. These are all of the occurrences when the Egyptians are said to be Pharaoh's Avadim. God says, "I will send my judgments on Pharaoh and on his servants." The point is, who are his servants? The Israelites aren't his servants, they're God's son. They're God's servants, they're not Pharaoh's servants. Then we find that there is one occurrence where the Israelites are called Pharaoh's servants, and this is when the foreman of the Israelites, so the chief amongst the Israelites who are being oppressed, want to creep up to Pharaoh. And so they say this is actually them reporting to Moses, isn't it? But the one time they say to Pharaoh, "We are your servants," this is the time they turn around and say to Moses, "The Lord look on you and judge, because you have made us to stink in the sight of Pharaoh and his servants," using that word avadim. So what we can say is actually the root Ayin Beit Dalet occurs more for what the Israelites go to after they have left Egypt in the book of Exodus than what they go from. Because God says to Moses, go to Pharaoh and say, "Let my people go that they may serve me." Now, there is this tendency in some early translations, such as the Greek, to use the word latruo, which often comes out as worship, for that particular root. But I think let's try and keep the words together just at the moment and recognize that actually what they go to after they've been in Egypt is service. So we have more occurrences of that root, Ayin Beit Dalet, for what they go to after leaving Egypt than what they had in Egypt. And there we have that God says to Moses, you shall serve God on this mountain. So if I can just conclude on that, we can say that the Israelites were slaves in Egypt because from our modern categories, they were slaves in Egypt. We can also say that from the categories of Deuteronomy, they were slaves in Egypt. But from the categories of the book of Exodus alone, we actually find a rather different emphasis. We find that the emphasis is on how Israel is God's son and therefore free. And Israel is God's servant and doesn't therefore belong to Pharaoh. It's quite a striking thing. Now, that does rather affect liberation theology, by the way. You might notice I've just blown it up. But there we are. Let's go on to another subject. Now, in terms of the way we view slavery, one really helpful thing is to go back to the creation. We have here the beautiful woodcut, which was by Josiah Wedgwood, who was Charles Darwin's grandfather and a liberationist, Am I Not a Man and a Brother, which I think is really inspired by this text from Job. If I've rejected the cause of my manservant or my maidservant when they brought a complaint against me, what then shall I do when God rises up? When he makes inquiry, what shall I answer him? Did not he who made me in the womb make him? And did not one fashion us in the womb? We can say that basically, when we go back to the very beginning, there is a sense of God making everyone and making them equal. Even when we consider Philip Schaff, who was in the position of not being abolitionist at the time of the Civil War, you know, he the anti-19 fathers and so on, done by that great scholar, what he would say is that according to the Old Testament, the institution of involuntary and perpetual servitude dates from after the fall and first appears as a punishment and curse. And there you have the fact that the word radah, to have dominion over, is used, of course, in the relationship between humans and animals before the fall, but it does not occur about human-human relationships still after the fall. And that's one of those words that occurs in our passage in Leviticus 25. Now, you might well still feel uncomfortable with what the Old Testament does, but here I think we can be helped by the distinction between permissive law and regulation. Sometimes what we have in the Old Testament is not saying this is good, but simply regulating this. How do we know? Well, go to what our Lord says on the question of divorce. He's asked about divorce, and he says, you are misreading the Torah. You are assuming that because Moses regulates something, he's actually approving of something. Now, just because some people draw up regulation about limiting gambling in a particular state or something like that does not mean they think gambling's a good idea. It simply means that they are seeking to regulate it. Now, if we apply Christ's hermeneutic to other topics and say, look at Moses, but then go back to the beginning and realize that the beginning is what gives us the pattern of how things should be, that will also help us on the subject of polygamy and on the subject of servitude. In the area of polygamy, we go back to the beginning, we see one man, one wife, and we find that as soon as people start having multiple wives, there are conflicts, whether it's in Abraham's family, Jacob's family, David's family, and so on. When we look at the question of servitude, we can also say before the fall, there is no dominion of one human over another. Even after the fall, the word which is said to the woman, interestingly, he shall rule over you, is the word marshal, which is less strong than the word radar, to have dominion. Now, someone might say, well, I accept that, but what about the New Testament? The New Testament is dealing with Greco-Roman slavery, which is obviously something different, and slaves are told to submit, and masters aren't told to free their slaves. So surely the New Testament approves of slavery. Well, of course, let's remember that at that time, Christians had no vote. So for Paul to spend his time writing, telling them what the ideal political system would be, somewhat like Plato might do in his Republic, wouldn't be a very helpful thing for most of the believers. In fact, if he encouraged slaves to rebel, they would be executed, rather like on the film Spartacus. But there are also limits, legal limits, to the emancipation of slaves. And this is, again, a research topic I would like someone here to go and pursue. That is, there are laws which say you can only limit, you can only free a certain number of your slaves. So, if, for instance, if you free them at your on your deathbed, if you've got 30 slaves, you can only free a third of them. If you've got three slaves, you can only free two. Or there are limits such as the Lex Aelia Sentia, which says that if you free someone under 30, then they can't become a Roman citizen without an awful lot of great difficulty. So what we can find is that simply to go and say free all your slaves wouldn't make them legally free necessarily. So there would be a danger there of conflict with the Roman system, just going off and freeing them and so on. We can also say that there are some further things in the New Testament. The emphasis on loving others as Christ loved us is a rather striking thing. Put that into practice, and really you will get a proper equality of treatment. Then the emphasis on brotherhood, that we are siblings, brothers and sisters, is a very striking thing. It would have been rather scandalous in the Roman world to be talking of people across social ranks in such sibling terminology. And rather than just it being a language game, what we find is that Christians put this into action with a vigorous kissing campaign. So it's not just that in Paul's letters you have the holy kiss, you also get it in 1 Peter. Now, one of the striking things about the holy kiss, some people like to say, well, that was part of their culture to greet each other with kisses. But hang on, was it part of their culture that Jew would kiss Gentile and that master would kiss slave? Surely not. Surely that would have been one of the most scandalous things to people of that day, that across these major boundaries, people are kissing each other. If you want to have an effective kissing campaign today, on campus or whatever, you need to start with the people you least want to kiss. The whole point of this is to break down those major barriers. And whom do you kiss, actually? You kiss those who are your siblings, your family. That's what kissing is about, in case you want to know. Now, what we find is that we also have in Paul's letters, Ephesians and Colossians and so on, the emphasis on equality, that masters are to give ta'auta to their servants. Now, does that mean they're supposed to give the same things to each of their servants, or does it not rather mean they're to give to each of their servants the same as they give to themselves? If they're not even to threaten, well, they're certainly not to hit. They're told that God doesn't prefer masters. And again, we get the language of equality, isotes, used in Colossians 4. We find in the case of Philemon, you say Philemon or something like that, yeah? Whatever. You know the book. Where Paul says to Philemon that he is to accept Onesimus no longer as a slave, but above a slave as a beloved brother. So that idea of brother is really key. And then what do you need to do in order to be saved? Well, you know Romans 10 verse 9. Don't you need to confess that Jesus is Lord? Jesus is Kurios. Jesus is Master. So the big watchword that's in all of their songs and everything like that is Jesus is Master. So the idea that Christians don't actually abolish slavery within the church is a rather odd idea, because every kurios has to realize that they themselves have a kurios. Everyone is under Christ, and everyone is both free from sin and a slave of Christ. Everyone was a slave of sin and free in regards to Christ. So in the church, you realize that these terms of slave and free are used universally of everyone, and the great thing about being a slave of Christ is it doesn't preclude you having the inheritance of a son, and so on. So all of these images come together. Now I want just to say a little bit about the trajectory hermeneutics. There was a significant book by William Webb called Slave Women and Homosexuals, in which he sought to make the argument that ran roughly like this. The Bible seems to approve of slavery, which is a premise I think I've tried to dispute. And yet we know that slavery is wrong, because actually we have some hints in the Bible that set us on the right path, such as Galatians 3:28, there being neither slave nor free. So in other words, the biblical texts don't necessarily need to arrive where we should actually be. He then says, but that doesn't apply in the case of homosexual practice, because we don't have hints that would set us on a path to say that's okay. But in the case of women's roles, the reason we should go to an egalitarian position is because there are hints that would set us on that path, such as Galatians 3:28. Now, one of the problems I have with this sort of trajectory, apart from the fact that I dispute the premise, which is that the biblical texts actually approve of slavery as currently defined, is actually there is a lack of control when you consider these sorts of things. Because the problem is, how can you tell what progress is unless you know what the end point is? How do you decide what higher principles are? How do you plot a graph, often between two points? And what about alternative trajectories? So I just want to do a very quick reductio ad absurdum of trajectory hermeneutics, if you don't mind. Can you find a mistake in this argument? Let's start with the subject of sex. In the Old Testament, polygamy seems to be allowed. In the New Testament, you have only monogamy if you're going to be a church leader. And then by the time we get to people like Augustine, sex is basically bad. Well, that seems to me a trajectory. Who is to say that the end point is actually bad? It may be self-evidently bad to people today, but it wasn't self-evidently bad to most of the monastic movements. So in other words, there is this problem about how we decide what is better and what is worse. A slightly more absurd one, but, you know, you may enjoy it. In the Old Testament, women are allowed to speak. In the New Testament, women are told to be silent in churches. And why not have it after the New Testament, women being silent in all situations? I mean, again, it's absurd. But the point is this. If we say that we have this trajectory, how do we decide what's good and bad? And this is where I think that some of that trajectory hermeneutic is problematic, because it actually has an outside idea of what is good, and that is then being imposed to spot progress in the biblical text. And so there are certain ideas within Webb of seed ideas which then get developed later. But how can we tell the difference between a seed idea which is to be developed later and a throwback? There isn't a good control on that. Well, those are my thoughts I'd share with you today. It's been wonderful to be with you for these two lectures, and I encourage you to believe that there aren't really any defeating moral objections to the Old Testament. Thank you.
Thank you again for listening to this chapel message from Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. If you are thinking about theological education on the undergraduate or graduate level, including doctoral studies, we hope that you consider us. If you also find these chapel messages encouraging and a blessing to your walk with Christ, we hope that you will consider financially supporting Southeastern. Our graduates are literally serving the kingdom across this globe, working to carry the gospel of Jesus Christ to a lost and dying world. Your gifts will help to train more, and they will serve as a worthwhile investment in God's kingdom. You can find more information about attending Southeastern or supporting us financially at www.sebts.edu. We covet your prayers and trust that God will bless every good work you do for His glory. Thank you for joining us in our chapel services.